From News Talk 580 1059 KMJ, this is the Matty Report, Valley Views Edition. Now here's your host, Mark Kepler.
This November, California voters will have their say on 17 ballot propositions and initiatives, the most measures on the state ballot since 2000. Several would make changes in the state's criminal justice system. Will they make us more or less safe? We'll hear from the state's authoritative voice for nonpartisan analysis, Mac Taylor, California's legislative analyst, and two experts in criminal justice with the Legislative Analyst Office, Drew Soderberg and Anita Lee. California's propositions. It's a crime. Or is it?
We'll also hear from Christine Bedell with the Bakersfield Californian, Mike Dunbar with the Merced Sun Star and the Modesto Bee, and Paul Hurley, formerly with the Visalia Times Delta.
Additional funding for the Matty Report made possible by a grant from the wonderful company, harvesting health and happiness around the world, and by Kaiser Permanente. Thrive. From the California Channel at the State Capitol and the Matty Institute, it's the Matty Report with Executive Director of the Matty Institute, Mark Kepler.
Welcome. This November, voters are going to be confronted with a myriad of initiatives and propositions. Our guest is Mac Taylor, California's legislative analyst, and he's tasked with the making sense of all these propositions for the rest of us. Welcome, Mac.
Thank you, Mark.
So, public wants to put something on the ballot. How does this process, how do you go about initiating something?
Well, that's one of the great things about California. Anybody can, in effect, be a California legislator. If you have an idea and a couple thousand dollars, you can have your proposed legislation, in effect, circulated amongst the people. You have to get a certain number of signatures. It's based on the prior vote for governor.
Right. That's important because the last vote for governor was kind of low, and so then the threshold of signatures you need is lower, which means it's – and actually, it costs you money to get those signatures. You have those people outside, the, you know, the food stores signing people up. They're not doing that for free. They're not volunteers.
Generally, no.
Right. And so it's cheaper then to put things on the ballot. So this time – we're seeing a lot of stuff on the ballot.
There was. Of the 17 measures that are going to be on the ballot, 14 of them were initiatives.
Wow.
So really, the ballot, as far as statewide measures, is dominated by the initiative process. So you go out, and if you get the required number of signatures, then it goes on the ballot. We do an analysis of that measure. The Attorney General does a title and summary to tell you what the nature of the measure is. And then that will show up in your voter guide that the people will be receiving this fall.
Now, we've had you on the program many times, usually around budget season, but folks should understand that your office is a non, it's called the Legislative Analyst Office, but that shouldn't be confused with you work for the legislature in a partisan way. You are nonpartisan, correct?
That's absolutely correct. We work for both houses, both parties, all 124 members of the legislature.
Okay, so let's talk about the LAO. We're going to do it briefly here. I'm not going to call you Legislative Analyst each time. The LAO's role in the ballot process, what exactly do you guys do?
Well, when an initiative is initially put through to when they want to have it circulated for signatures, we do a quick fiscal analysis with the administration's budget office. Now, when it qualifies, when it actually gets the signatures and goes on the ballot, then we do a lengthier analysis, just my office, that describes the measure, talks about its effects on state and local government. And that's the lengthier analysis that will show up in the voter guide.
And that's things that folks really ought to read.
Well, I think it provides helpful information. Sometimes there's background and context, the effect on state and local governments. It's not going to tell you everything that you might want to know. And obviously, you can't expect people to read all 17, but they may selectively want to go and read some more background if they want to learn a little bit more.
But it's as the more I've been involved in this, the more I rely on the LAO for really good advice. And I want to just let our audience know, if you really want to learn about a topic and you want to get an unvarnished truth about that topic, a great place to look is the LAO website. They really go into detail and try to cover both sides of the issue and do a really nice job. So hats off to you guys. You know, but you haven't always been doing this. This is, I guess, what, 1974 Prop 9 gave you this responsibility?
Yes, that was put on the ballot by then Secretary of State, Jerry Brown.
Oh, okay. So it all comes back full circle. I wonder if he's happier or not that he did that. So let's talk about some of these ballot propositions that are on the November ballot. As you mentioned, there are 17 of them. There are different things that make up, you know, these ballot propositions. You've got voter initiatives. You've got some put on by the legislature. You've got referendums. Can you kind of describe all of that?
Certainly. Like I said, of the 17 total measures that people can vote on this November, 14 of them were put on by initiative.
Okay.
One was put on by referendum, and that was another one of the big three progressive reformers back in the early part of the 20th century. the Hiram Johnson sort
what
of
was
reforms.
Their, what was their idea of putting these, allowing the voters to put these things on
at
the ballot?
At the time, the power of the railroads was sort of predominant, and it was sort of the people's way to sort of circumvent certain big moneyed interests, is the way I guess the progressives would phrase it. But anyway, it's just the power of the people acting in effect as the legislature. So in an initiative, you're actually proposing a law, just like a legislative body would. On the referendum, it's a little bit different. It's when the legislature has passed a law, but the people will collect signatures to say, before it goes into effect, we want the people to vote on this law. Wow. And that's the one referendum we have on the single-use plastic bags initiative.
That's right. And it's interesting, though, you mentioned that, because you think about the progressive movement and the reason for this, the proposition, the initiative process, the referendum, to let the voters decide. A lot of these things are bankrolled today by special interests.
So, well, yeah, I don't know how you would define special interests, but certain by interest groups sponsor these in a way. But it is the people's ability to go in and propose whatever sort of initiatives they want.
So up next, we're actually going to talk a little bit about some of those initiatives with some of the staff that works at the Legislative Analyst's Office. And we're going to look at one of the more controversial ones up next, and that is the legalization of recreational marijuana. That conversation next. This is the Maddie Report.
For a more in-depth analysis of this and other public policy issues important to Californians, please log on to our website at maddieinstitute.org and click on the Policy Analysis tab.
Welcome. One of the measures receiving the most attention on this year's ballot is Prop 64, which would legalize marijuana for recreational purposes. Now, California voters rejected a similar measure back in 2010, but since then, four states, Colorado, Washington, Alaska, Oregon, and the District of Columbia, have passed measures legalizing the recreational use of marijuana. Our guest is Drew Soderberg. He's an expert in criminal justice and a managing principal analyst with the LAO. Welcome.
Thank you.
So, Drew, let's start talking about this issue, about where we are right now. What is the current state and federal law as it relates to marijuana?
Sure. So we'll start with state law. Marijuana, of course, is illegal under state law, and penalties range from fines for possession to prison or jail time for marijuana sales. However, voters legalized marijuana for medical uses in 1996. In addition, the state—
20 years ago.
That's correct. Yeah. So it's been quite a while. In that time period, there wasn't a great deal of regulation, but the amount of regulation has increased recently. So the legislature recently passed a series of bills to increase the regulation.
They may have seen this coming, and they wanted to have something in place before it potentially passes.
It's possible that may have been.
And the federal government, is there a legalization of marijuana there?
No. So under federal law, marijuana is illegal, even for medical use, and even in states that have legalized it. However, the U.S. Department of Justice generally doesn't prosecute marijuana users or businesses if they're abiding by state law. And those state laws are written and enforced in a way to uphold federal priorities, like preventing marijuana from getting diverted to other states or going to children.
Yeah, going to children. So in other words, there is a federal law that says no. There's a state law that says yes. And the feds could preempt.
Correct.
The state. But they've decided to keep hands off as long as they follow certain guidelines.
Correct.
Okay. Now we've got this ballot measure. How would it change marijuana regulation in California?
Sure. So Prop 64 can really be thought of in four different pieces. First, it legalizes the non-medical use of marijuana for adults age 21 and over. So individuals, for example, could smoke it in their home, but there would be some restrictions. So you couldn't generally smoke it in public. Second, it would create a system for regulating the recreational marijuana market that would be largely similar to the one adopted for the medical marijuana market.
So you kind of know what you're getting, right? I mean, if someone's buying marijuana in the medical market today, at least you know the THC levels and then those kinds of things. If you're buying it on the street, you don't know what you're getting.
That would be the hope of the proponents, okay. Yes. And then the third aspect is that it imposes taxes both on medical marijuana and non-medical marijuana. It imposes a tax on the growing of marijuana and on the selling of marijuana, and directs that the revenues raised be directed to specific things, for example, youth programs, environmental protection, and law enforcement.
They got you coming and going. They're going to get you both ways, growing and selling. Okay, and there's also a fourth thing, is they're changing the penalties, correct?
That's correct. The last thing is that they're generally reducing marijuana penalties, though some marijuana penalties remained unchanged, such as driving while intoxicated by marijuana. Those penalties wouldn't change.
Okay, and also selling marijuana, now you can get up to, I understand, 4 years in state prison or county jail. And in the future, What?
So in the future, the penalty would come down. So it would depend on what exactly the violation was. But individuals would be subject to civil penalties for not selling, not having a license to sell. And they could be subject to, I believe, misdemeanor penalties.
Now, the big issue here, the elephant in the room, is the fiscal impact of legalizing recreational marijuana. You know, you think of some areas like Humboldt County that could stand to, frankly, bring a lot of revenue in if this passes. What is the fiscal impact of legalizing recreational marijuana, not just for a particular area like Northern California, but the state generally?
So there's a lot of uncertainties about what the fiscal impact will be. So I kind of want to preface some of these comments by putting those out there first. How state and local governments choose to tax and regulate marijuana will affect it, whether the federal government changes policy and starts enforcing marijuana laws, and then finally, how marijuana prices and consumption change following legalization. However, those sort of caveats in mind, we estimate that state and local governments could eventually get new revenues in the high hundreds of millions to over $1 billion. But it's important to note that it could take several years before that level of revenue
comes in. Now, it's only in state government. You say, oh, $100 million, that's not a lot of money. But just to put it in context, the state budget is about, $122 billion.
Mm-hmm.
So this would be $1 billion out of a $122 billion budget. So it's significant. $1 billion is significant. But in the scheme of things, it's less than 1%.
That's true. And it's important to remember that all that money would be directed to specific purposes, like I mentioned,
or
a significant portion of it, excuse me.
Okay. Well, up next, we're going to talk about some crime and safety measures on the November ballot. That conversation in a moment. This is the Matty Report. Welcome back. We're talking with experts from the state's Legislative Analyst Office about the 17 measures on this November's general election ballot. We're going to talk about crime and safety next. The LAO's Drew Soderberg is with us still. So let's talk about Prop 57. Governor Brown's initiative that would allow early release of inmates convicted of some specific nonviolent crimes. Can you set the stage? Where are we right now on criminal sentencing?
Sure. So individuals in prison have been convicted of a primary offense that they're serving time for. However, they may also be serving additional time for sentencing enhancements or other crimes they may have committed.
So it's kind of a stack. They stack things on. There's the primary crime, you rob somebody, and then there's maybe a lesser crime, you used a gun, and oh, maybe there's an enhancement of something like you were in a gang.
Exactly.
So it adds up.
The three strikes law is probably the most prominent example of enhancements that have been implied. However, inmates can reduce the amount of time they serve through sentencing credits. These credits are typically awarded for participation in rehab or educational programs or good behavior, but state law really limits the amount of credits that the state prison system can award.
So when you're up for parole, if you have, you know, the primary sentence and they got the lesser crime, then you have the enhancements, when are you up for parole? At what point are you up for currently?
Well, it will depend on your sentence. So if there are indeterminately sentenced individuals who have received sentences like 25 years to life, they would be up for parole on their 25th year.
Okay.
However, there are some determinately sentenced individuals who qualify for parole hearings in addition. So a good example is if you committed your crime before you were the age of 18, you're eligible for a parole consideration hearing. I believe it's in the 15th year of your sentence.
Okay, so how would Prop 57 change the current system?
So Prop 57 would change the system for adults by changing the state constitution so that individuals are eligible for parole consideration, assuming they've committed a nonviolent offense, after they've served their primary term. That means that at the discretion of the Board of Parole hearings, they might be released before they would serve any additional time for sentencing enhancements.
So that secondary crime, that enhancement wouldn't be counted. They just focus on the primary crime, and that's where they decide where parole is appropriate.
Exactly. And then the other major change is that the Constitution would be changed to give the state prison system broad authority toward inmates' credits.
What's going to be the fiscal impact on the state and local governments?
So the primary fiscal impact is really from the changes to the adult system, and we estimate that there could be savings for the state, net savings in the tens of millions of dollars.
So that's because they're not housing these people in state prison. But that means
exactly.
They're on the street. What is the calculation for the cost of maybe the crimes that they commit now that they're on the street?
Well, so when they go out on the street, they'll either be supervised by counties or by the state. Though it's important to note that the counties and state would have supervised them likely eventually anyways, and so those aren't necessarily new costs. Now, there could be additional costs associated with new crimes they commit, though it's difficult to estimate exactly how many additional crimes would be committed or if the measure would just change the timing of those crimes.
One of the things is because they're allowing for more credits for good behavior, getting education.
That's one
of the arguments for the proponents is they're saying, listen, it's more likely these people are going to reenter society and they're not going to commit crimes because we're giving them incentive in prison to change their behavior. So
that's correct.
Kind of tough to know what the costs are going to be. Anita Lee, who's a criminal justice expert with the LAO, is also joining us. I'm going to talk about Prop 63, mm-hmm. and that deals with guns and ammunition.
Yes.
That sounds like a hot topic. So let's talk about currently, where are we on the situation with the sales of guns and ammunition in California?
Sure. So first thing to kind of realize is in California, prohibited persons or certain individuals who are convicted of felonies and certain misdemeanors are not allowed to possess firearms or ammunition. So firearms dealers currently have to request background checks from the state to ensure that people who are buying firearms are not prohibited at the time they're trying to purchase them. Prior to this year, the state...
Let's assume that the database is correct, too.
Yes, okay. Yes. And so prior to this year, the state didn't regulate ammunition sales in the same way that it did firearms. Okay. But the state passed recently enacted legislation in July to increase the regulation of ammunition sales, most notably by requiring that state-licensed ammunition dealers would be required to check with the state to ensure that people seeking to buy ammunition were not prohibited.
There's going to be a rush on stores now probably to buy ammunition before this thing passes. But so there are restrictions on the possession of guns and ammunition mm-hmm. in California. And there, and people don't realize, some people think that anybody can get a gun. Mm-hmm. There are restrictions. There are certain people that you've created felonies and misdemeanors, if you're a danger to yourself or others, if there's a restraining order against you, mm-hmm. all of those are reasons why you may not be allowed to have a gun.
Yeah.
So what would Prop 63 do exactly?
Sure. Proposition 63 has a number of different provisions. One major provision is that it would create a new court process to ensure the removal of firearms from prohibited persons at the time that they are convicted. It also includes a number of various provisions that are similar to recently enacted law for increasing regulation of ammunition sales, such as licenses to sell ammunition or background checks prior to selling ammunition.
You know, it was interesting that the state auditor did a report a little while ago about these folks that aren't supposed to have weapons. You know, mm-hmm. people have committed felonies and whatnot, and how, frankly, a poor job the state has done in getting those weapons back from people who have felonies. And maybe this is a response to that. So what's the fiscal impact of Prop 63 on state and local governments?
Sure. It really breaks down into three portions. So first, related to the new court process, that's likely to result in state and local court and law enforcement costs potentially in the tens of millions of dollars annually.
Because you've got to enforce this.
Yes.
Okay.
Related to the changes to ammunition regulations, that's likely to increase state costs as well, but those would generally be offset by the various fees that are authorized by this measure and existing
law. Otherwise known as taxes. Okay.
And then finally, the measure does change certain penalties related to firearms and ammunition violations. And so those changes could result in net state and local correctional costs potentially, not likely to exceed the low millions of dollars annually.
Okay. Well, up next, we're going to talk about the other end of the continuum of crime. That is the death penalty. Should it be made easier to enforce, or should it be abolished completely? That conversation in a moment. This is the Maddie Report. Welcome. We're talking with experts from the nonpartisan State Legislative Analyst Office about a number of crime-related measures on the November ballot. California has two death penalty measures, competing measures on the ballot. Prop 62 would abolish the death penalty, while Prop 66 would shorten legal challenges and essentially speed up the process. Anita Lee with the LAO is still with us. She's a program policy expert on criminal justice generally and the death penalty specifically. So, before we get into the details of these two measures, what is the current status of the death penalty in California?
Sure. As of April 2016, 748 condemned inmates were in state prison with death sentences. These inmates are entitled to legal challenges in both federal and state courts, and they're really challenged in two ways: direct appeals and habeas corpus petitions. These legal challenges take a couple of decades to complete in California due to a variety
decades.
Of factors. Decades, yes.
So we're talking like 20 years.
20, sometimes even longer than
wow.
that.
Okay.
And there are various reasons for these delays, including significant delays in the appointment of attorneys to represent those contenders.
First, you got to have an attorney, and that takes a while to get a person appointed, and then
sure.
you have to start the whole process.
And you have different attorneys for the different types, the
okay.
direct appeal and the habeas corpus appeals. And so most of the inmates who are on death row are actually at various stages of the legal challenge process. On top of that, due to various legal issues surrounding the state's lethal injection procedures, no executions have taken place since 2006. And the state's currently in the process of developing regulations to allow executions to resume.
So the reality is we have a death penalty on the books, mm-hmm. but it's not being enforced.
Yes.
And my understanding, looking at the numbers in your report, mm-hmm. 80% of those that were convicted are on death row are still in state prison. 11% died prior to execution, 7% had their sentences reduced, and only 2% have been executed since 1978. Since 1978, only
yeah.
2%.
So, I mean, to give a little bit of frame of reference, since 1978, it's 930 individuals who received death sentences, mm-hmm. and 15 have been executed.
Yeah, it's a very, very, very small number.
Yeah.
Okay, so we got these two competing death mm-hmm. penalty measures on
yes.
the ballot. We'll start with Prop 62.
Yes.
Now, that would abolish the death penalty. What are the major provisions of that proposition?
So under Proposition 62, offenders and existing inmates can no longer be sentenced to death for first-degree murder. Instead, the most serious penalty available would be life without the possibility of parole. The measure would also specify that inmates who are found guilty of murder have to work while they're in state prison and have their wages deducted to pay victims of crime.
Well, it's not like they're making a lot of money. I'm assuming it's
that's,
like minimum wage or subminimum wage.
That's a fair point. It's also subject to state regulations. So CDCR, the Department of Corrections, has regulations for, you know, different security levels and who's allowed to work and who isn't.
So right now, though, if they're on death row and they're or life without possibility mm-hmm. of parole, they're still working. They still now today give money to the victims?
They do. This measure would increase the percentage from 50% to 60% of the amount that could be deducted.
Okay. So what is the fiscal impact, you think, of if the death penalty was abolished? What
sure.
would that cost? Is it cheaper to, frankly, to execute someone or to have them be in prison for the rest of their life?
So when we looked at Proposition 62, we did estimate that it would reduce net state and local costs by around $150 million annually within a few
so
years.
So let me get this straight. So it's your analysis is it's less expensive to keep someone in prison for life than to go through the execution, that process.
Yeah, so the $150 million really breaks down to two portions. The first portion is that you would have reduced costs from reduced workload to the state and local courts, the attorneys at the local level,
because
housing them.
Because now you're not going to be doing that second phase about whether
yes.
a death penalty applies, just automatically life without
yeah,
parole.
Yeah, you're not going to be doing the second phase. Attorneys, so local attorneys will staff more attorneys if it's a death penalty case. County jails have to house them until they're done. And then on the flip side, at the state prison level when they're housed, it's generally more expensive for the prisons to house condemned inmates because there are higher security measures to house and supervise the condemned inmates than compared to
now they'd be in the general population.
Life without the possibility of parole, so they'd be subject to kind of other security requirements. They could be, but they're, you know, it's also possible.
Let's
that
talk about the other end of the continuum, and that's Prop 66, okay. which would instead speed up executions. What are the major provisions in that proposition?
Yeah, so it really seeks to shorten the time that legal challenges take. And so there are a number of provisions. One thing that it requires is that habeas corpus petitions, one way to legally challenge a death sentence, be heard at the trial courts instead of the California Supreme Court. It also places time limits on the legal challenges and changes the process for appointing attorneys to these condemned inmates. It also does a variety of other things, including exempting the state's execution procedures from state requirements for members of the public to have an opportunity to weigh in on the development of the regulations.
Yeah, I think it was the Administrative Procedures. This is a little technical, but the Administrative
yeah.
Procedures
it's
Act are saying you don't have to follow
Act.
That. Normally, when you do rules and regulations, you do have to follow that.
Mm-hmm.
So they are really making
it
this
would
thing,
cut that out.
Expediting
yes.
this.
Mm-hmm.
So what's the fiscal impact?
So the fiscal impact related to this is that the ongoing state court costs for each individual legal challenge is pretty uncertain. That's because some of the provisions could reduce costs and some of them could increase costs. However, given the hundreds of pending cases, it is likely that in the near term, we're going to have state court costs potentially in the tens of millions of dollars annually from accelerating spending to meet the timeframes imposed by the measure. This would result in savings of similar amounts in future years.
Initially, it would cost a little more money.
But yes, and then also on the state prison side, you could have savings potentially in the tens of millions of dollars to the extent that the state changes how it houses the prisoners or additional executions take place.
Okay, so it's probably that's a hard one to call. I guess it's uncertain.
One. Yes.
Okay, that's a good way to end up. Well, I want to thank the state legislative analyst Mac Taylor and his staff, Anita Lee and Drew Soderberg, for joining us. If you want to stay current with state and local politics, you can follow the Maddie Report on Facebook or Twitter, or log on to our website at MaddieInstitute.org and get us on the Maddie Daily. This is Mark Kepler for the Maddie Report. Thanks for joining us.
The views expressed in the Maddie Report are those of the individuals participating in the program and do not necessarily reflect those of the California Channel or the Maddie Institute. If you'd like to share your thoughts about the points and opinions expressed on the Maddie Report, visit our website at MaddieInstitute.org.
You're listening to the Maddie Report, Valley Views Edition on KMJ.
What does the November ballot mean for the Valley? We've got some of the best observers of Valley politics with us to talk about what these criminal justice issues may mean for the Valley. We have Christine Bedell with the Bakersfield, California. Welcome, Christine.
Hello.
We've got Mike Dunbar with the Merced Sun Star and the Modesto Bee. Welcome, Mike.
Glad to be here.
From the other end of the Valley. And we also have Paul Hurley, formerly with the Visalia Times Delta. Welcome, Paul.
Hi, Mark. Thanks for having me.
Okay, welcome to all of you. So, Paul Hurley, I'm going to start with you. Before we get started talking about the specific propositions, I wanted to pick up on our conversation in the earlier segment about the initiative process itself. You know, we've got 17 ballots on the November ballot. This thing is going to be gargantuan, this voter guide, 224 pages. Is this any way to run a government?
No, it's not a good way to run a government. For some major things, I think probably the public should weigh in directly. Yeah, it's direct democracy. But this ballot's going to be crazy. And when you put on the fact that that we're going to be electing a president of the United States and a full House of Congress and legislature and all kinds of local things, and we've got at least three or four local measures here down in Visalia and Tulare County, it's going to overwhelm a typical voter. The typical voter is going to go in there and just hit the no, check the no box right 17 times. I'm sorry, but I think that's the way it's going to go.
You know, I think a lot of people probably would agree with you on that. Mike Dunbar up in Merced and Modesto, what do you think? Are propositions good for the Valley? I mean, since the Valley seems to lack political clout in Sacramento, this may be a way to get Valley issues addressed?
Well, I think it is. I agree with what Paul was saying, but there's a caveat. I mean, the reason we do things this way in California, you know, dates back to Hiram Johnson. And
that's a long time ago.
That's a long time ago. And I don't think the needs have changed. I mean, sometimes government is not responsive. And, I mean, take Prop 53. That's just an act of frustration. And I think that you've got to have some mechanism. Now, should we have some better controls or better way of altering how we amplify these issues? I believe we should. But I think you're right. This may be the only way we can get any attention to some of our issues.
You know, it's interesting. You mentioned Hiram Johnson. That was, you know, over 100 years ago. And the idea there was that the initiative process would be a tool to help level the playing field against special interests. But a lot of people argue today that's who drives the process. It's the special interests. It's the billionaires who have the money to put these things on the ballot. But what are your thoughts, Christine Bedell from the Bakersfield, California? What are your thoughts on propositions and initiatives? They help the Valley, hurt the Valley?
I like the system. I mean, I know it's messy. I know it can get complicated and overwhelming. But and sometimes voters get it wrong. The courts have to say, you know what, that's not exactly constitutional. But I think it's better to have people involved in government. You know, I was doing some gardening last weekend in the front yard, and a guy came by wanting me to sign a petition for a local pot initiative. And obviously, I couldn't sign it because I can't because of my job. But I thought it was great. I had like a 20-minute conversation with the guy about the proposition and his involvement in it and why he was involved. And I thought it was great.
Well, you know, Mike, that kind of leads us to the specific measures. Let's start with the...
Mark? I would agree that when you local measures like that, that is good. That when you're getting people involved that way on a local thing that really affects how they live, you know, that's fine. But a lot of these propositions that are going to be on the statewide ballot are really quite far from where most people are living.
Well, Paul, let me follow up then on this thing with you. Let's talk about some of the specific measures, and you're kind of bringing up Prop 64, which is the recreational use of marijuana, making that legal. What are your thoughts on that? Is that going to be, you know, the Valley's new cash crop? What do you think, Paul?
Yeah, that's a good question. I would think that there are some people who expect it to be. I know that there are already national corporations who are setting up their infrastructure to grow marijuana in California when that passes, not if. I mean, legalization of marijuana it will pass in California at some point, if not this November, in a subsequent vote. And I'm afraid that there will be downsides. There just haven't been enough research into the effects of marijuana. There's almost every other day, there's a story about law enforcement wanting to find a way to monitor impairment of drivers, how it affects crime, how it affects other kinds of substance abuse. There's going to be a lot of questions about this, and California is going to end up being the laboratory, the test tube, following California, Colorado, and Oregon.
Yeah, it's interesting.
Finding out what the effects are going to be.
In Colorado, it's a $2 billion industry already. So Mike Dunbar with Mercedes Sun Star and the Modesto Bee, what are your thoughts about Prop 64, the legalization of recreational use of marijuana? You know, do the downsides that Paul was talking about potentially DUI issues, you know, there's a DUI, was it 0.08 for driving under the influence for alcohol? There is no such measure for driving under the influence of marijuana. In fact, if you take a look at the reports that officers use, it's frankly very subjective factors that they use, you know, whether or not the person has a steady gait or whether they're slurring their speech. And that's open to a lot of interpretation. So anyway, what are your thoughts on Prop 64?
Well, first off, as far as the interpretation that the officer is going to give, there's no clear measure. I mean, THC, the chemical compound, stays in the bloodstream for up to 30 days. So you can't really tell when a person smoked marijuana or ingested marijuana. Now, they're trying to develop something over in Berkeley that will measure the content.
I was going to say, of course they are, Mike.
Yeah, of course they are. And so I think and that breaks down a lot more quickly. And so I think that we'll be able to get some things. But who's going to pay to re-outfit all of our officers with the ability to test this stuff? I mean, there's a lot of questions in terms of enforcement. We're going to have the lieutenant governor in here today to talk to us about it. And the more we study, the less convinced we are, although I would say, like Paul, I believe this one's a slam dunk.
Yeah, but there's a lot of money. I mean, isn't this in some ways a money issue? It's going to generate a lot of tax revenue. Don't you think?
Well, it will.
It will.
Yeah, but we're not going to see this as a cash crop. I mean, if you look at what Oregon did, you cannot grow it outdoors except under very tight controls. So virtually everyone growing this grows it indoors. That's not true in California now. You go up to the Emerald Triangle, you've got a lot of marijuana patches.
You're talking about Humboldt County and up there, right?
Yep, Humboldt County. And so they're growing it outdoors up there. But if you look at what these people are doing in Colorado and Oregon and Washington, it's a very tightly controlled place. I mean, even with air exchangers, they don't even want people walking by on the sidewalk smelling it.
Yeah, you know,
so it's going to be a big crop, but I don't know if it'll be grown here.
Okay, Paul, I'm going to switch gears a little bit and talk about Prop 57. That's Governor Brown's initiative that would allow for the early release of prison inmates convicted of specific nonviolent crimes. Made a lot of news in the Valley. The governor left a voicemail message with Fresno County Sheriff Margaret Mims. Of course, the governor could have called virtually anybody in the valley, and they probably would have found law enforcement generally opposes Prop 57. The underlying logic of the opposition seems to be that incarceration is a disincentive to those thinking about committing crime. It's a good, you know, crime-fighting technique. But, you know, we talked in the earlier segment with folks, and they seem to think that the data suggests at least that hiring more police officers is a more effective crime fighting strategy. So, you know, I assume that the easy political answer is, oh, they'll just do both, right? We just hire more police officers, lock more people up. But that all the above strategy, regardless of cost, is that really tenable in the valley where we have all these needs on a local government?
Yeah. It's a tough question. The trend is to less punishment, less incarceration, and more rehabilitation and prevention. I don't know if that's going to apply. The funny thing is that it's not the same with drug offenses, at least not in the rest of the country. That's still the number one reason why people get locked up in prison underlying. Hiring more cops and putting more prevention, crime fighting strategy on the streets, it has shown to be more effective than putting people in jail. But there's another problem there. There's a shortage of police nationwide, and it's getting harder and harder to attract good people into law enforcement. Here in Tulare County in Visalia, the agencies here are having a hard time hiring enough cops. And some agencies, such as Porterville, they're offering incentives like, we'll make a down payment on your house if you join our police department. We'll give you a $4,000 signing bonus if you sign up for our police department. So there's a lot of conflicting forces going on here. I can understand why law enforcement and Sheriff Mims and probably Sheriff Boudreau here in Tulare County too oppose the governor's releasing more people into the community, even for nonviolent crimes. They're the ones who have to clean up the mess afterwards. But at some point, we need to devote resources to the prevention and to fight the underlying problems that cause crime, that is poverty, lack of opportunity, et cetera.
Christine, I'm wondering, is the same thing, are you seeing the same thing in Bakersfield? Opposition to
in terms of difficulty.
Well, just the opposition to the Prop 57, this early release of inmates that are supposed to be involved with nonviolent crimes, not really liking that idea.
Absolutely, our law enforcement always opposes those kinds of measures. Now, the Californian has come out in favor of 57, saying basically that these people are going to be released anyway because of overcrowding. At least with 57, it's judges that are making the call. So they came out for it. One thing I do want to say is I have been surprised that there has been more emphasis in Kern County Board of Supervisors, in particular, toward devoting more resources to rehabilitation and, being willing to make cuts to public safety.
So basically,
due to some terrible budget cuts that we've been having to deal with, they wanted across the board funding cuts for government services. Law enforcement put up a big fight and even said, you should shut down all the libraries before you should, cut public safety anymore. And the board held the line on the cuts. So I've seen a willingness to, put more emphasis on rehabilitation here.
The problem with that is it's a long-term strategy, right? I mean, you put the money in, but you don't necessarily see the results immediately. And in politics, politicians like to see the results, and then the public too, more immediately than maybe attacking the systemic problems of crime. But Mike Dunbar, up in Modesto and Merced, what are your thoughts on Prop 57, the governor's initiative to release inmates convicted of specific nonviolent crimes?
Well, we had Larry Morrison, he's the DA in Merced County, and Birgit Flatiger, the DA in Stanislaw County, and the Modesto Police Chief, Galen Carolyn, here yesterday to talk to us about it. And, one of the things they point to is that crimes are going up, and they're going up pretty significantly. We're back, in terms of violent crimes, we're back to 2009 levels after five straight years of decreases.
Yeah, so, doesn't that have to be put in context, though? The reality is, we did in an earlier segment, we were talking about, yes, there's been a spike in crime recently, but if you look at historical averages, we're at or near historical lows, even though it has spiked in the last few years.
Yes, we are, but when you see the trend begin to turn, and I think that's what we're doing, it plateaued it reached its nadir, if you will, in 2013, and remained the same in 2014, roughly. But now it took a fairly significant jump, or it's taken a fairly significant jump, and it's crime across the board. So, you know, we had Prop 47, and if you talk to the law enforcement people, Prop 47 is the reason that we've seen these increases.
Just to be clear about that, Mike, that's the, you know, nonviolent, non-sexual, non-serious crimes that they were releasing them earlier.
The county jails.
The county jails, right.
Mm-hmm. And they're saying now that our county jail, the term that was used, our county jail is like a windmill. They come in and sometimes 12 hours later they're released. And there's some things in this proposition that do some very sketchy things. There's some elements of this proposition that do that. Like, for instance, if somebody steals, they rob three different stores, and none of their items that they've stolen exceed the threshold for grand larceny, then they can only be charged with a misdemeanor, even though if they combine the three crimes, they could be charged with a felony. So there's some elements about this that I think are disturbing.
Yeah,
I asked them if this is something that criminals are even aware of, and all three of the law enforcement people laughed out loud. They say they keep a calculator in their head of how much they've stolen.
We have to end this segment because we're coming up against the time block here. But it's just interesting. I'm wondering how many of those criminals are going to be reading that 224-page voter guide and seeing, you know, the specifics of that measure. But up next, we're going to look at two highly charged issues on the November ballot, the death penalty and gun control. That conversation in a moment. This is the Matty Report, Valley Views Edition.
You're listening to the Matty Report, Valley Views Edition. On KMJ.
Welcome back. We're talking with political observers from throughout the Valley. Paul Hurley, formerly with the Visalia Times Delta. Christine Bedell with the Bakersfield Californian. Mike Dunbar with the Merced Sun Star and the Modesto Bee about some of the criminal justice measures on the November ballot. So, Paul Hurley in Visalia, I want to ask you about two of the death penalty measures on the November ballot. Prop 62, which would repeal the death penalty, and Prop 66, which would speed it up. So, either ends of the continuum. As noted earlier, the last Californian executed was in 2006. And interestingly enough, that was for a crime committed in Fresno. Given how the measures are polling, they're very even. Do you think the Valley is going to end up being the one that casts the deciding vote here?
The Valley might end up casting the deciding vote. Frankly, I don't if people looked at it clinically, I don't see why they would not repeal the death penalty. It's not working. It's not a deterrent. And the number of people that California is supporting on death row grows every year. The Valley will probably vote against Prop 62, I would guess. Looking at the supporters, the sheriffs, DAs, elected officials are all oppose it. In the Valley anyway, and most of the people who support it in California are more liberal. So if it is a deciding vote, it'll be no. As far as Proposition 66, and I presume that gets eliminated if the death penalty is repealed, so it will be a moot point. But it's sort of a fool promise that think that they can enact some controls that can expedite the process for executing a person. There are some federal mandates in there about executing the death penalty that I know Texas manages it because they put people to death much more regularly than California does. But I can't see how Prop 66 would be effective.
Yeah, I think that's the frustration of folks who are for the death penalty, that it's not being being implemented. But Mike Dunbar, up north on Modesto, Merced, what are your thoughts on these two measures on the death penalty?
Well, I mean, do we really want to become Texas? I mean, that's where what I would suggest. And I hope people don't want to become Texas. But think about this. Texas last year gave the death penalty to two people. In California, yeah, we had somewhere north of 60 get the death penalty. So all these people are waiting, trying to, and the state is trying to execute them. If they do speed it up, it's going to be a lot of people. I just don't see it happening. I hope people abolish the death penalty. That's how we're going to editorialize. And I think that 66 should go down to defeat no matter what.
Yeah. Well, let me ask you, Christine Bedell in Bakersfield, about, you know, the whole how this all works together, the death penalty propositions and this Prop 63 that attempts to place background checks on ammunition purchases and the purchase of large capacity magazines. It almost sounds like these are the kind of wedge issues that really will drive voters to the polls. Do you think in Kern County that this is going to drive these kinds of issues are going to drive voters to the polls?
Well, I don't know about that. The voters who don't tend to go to the polls here are, you know, Latinos, Democrats, that sort of thing. So I don't know, you know, if people who are, you know, for these criminal justice measures, if they need to be driven to the polls. I think the presidential election, more than anything, is what's going to drive turnout here on both sides.
Yeah, that's probably true. You know, look, Paul, let me ask you then about this. You know, notoriously, the Valley, you know, the state has very low turnout rates, but the Valley's even worse. A lot of voters just don't show up to vote.
Yeah.
Are these kinds of issues going to get people excited, or is it going to be, you know, Donald Trump, Hillary Clinton, the presidential election?
Well, I think Donald Trump, Hillary Clinton is going to be the thing that drives people to the polls and will increase voter turnout this year. But among the propositions, those wedge issues, the background checks on ammunition, the death penalty, legalization of marijuana, those will get some attention. And people, I think, in the Valley will vote on those. Those will be the exception to the "I'm just going to go down and vote no on everything." Couple of those wedge issues, I think people will single out and give some thought to, or at least apply them to what their sort of their political philosophy is or their lifestyle, and make a conscious vote. But voter turnout is really going to be driven by the national presidential race.
So Mike Dunbar up north, do you agree with your compatriots down south?
Oh, absolutely. If anything is going to bring out additional voters, it will be Donald Trump, and that's for and against. I think the big question is whether the Latino vote is finally going to become energized by this.
Yes.
So will that then translate to the votes on the propositions? You know, I think it's as Paul said, some of them, but most of them no.
Yeah, you know, let me ask you this, Mike. You know, Fresno County's had a high number of concealed carry handgun permits in the state. It's a similar issue. It's not on the ballot, but it's an issue that's kind of big here in the Valley. You know, Fresno County, Kern, Tulare, Stanislaus, they basically lead the state in the number of these things called CCWs, concealed carry permits. You know, I'm wondering, do you think that it would be a good idea to – a lot of supporters think that's it's a crime deterrent. Do you think it would be a good idea to maybe study that issue as a potential, you know, hiring more police officers or incarcerating more people or maybe these, you know, giving more CCWs out, permits out as a good crime prevention method? Should that be studied?
Well, I do not believe it's a good prevention of crime. I think that's a fantasy that a lot of people who get these permits truly believe. But I don't think they prevent crimes.
I would love to see this become one of the first study topics of the I think it's at UC Davis, where they're going to start studying gun violence in California.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's a worthy topic, but I think the sheriff's and our sheriff in Stanislaus County, Adam Christensen, is one of them. I think that they need to reconsider how easy they make it to give these permits out.
Well, what about down south, Christine, you know, in Kern County? What's the situation down there? They seem to have a pretty high number of concealed carry permits in Kern County. A crime deterrent? Should we study this issue?
As a journalist, I think that would be, you know, absolutely fascinating. I would love to see something like that done. I don't hear a whole lot of cases down here of people with CCW permits preventing a crime, but maybe it does happen and we just don't hear about it. So, yeah, I'm always interested in learning more about how that might affect crime, because we're one of the top counties for CCW permits. It's a hot topic down here.
Yeah, well, Paul, what about Terry?
If I could just add quickly, concealed carry permits and any gun control or Second Amendment things are not specifically on the California ballot, but it will be the big elephant in the room. And I think a lot of candidates will probably address that, because in the current climate, and especially with some of the other measures that are on the California ballot, attention to so-called Second Amendment rights is going to be a prominent topic among candidate forums and debates, et cetera. So it's actually a big campaign issue across the board, even if it's not specifically on the ballot.
Well, do you think it should be studied, though?
Oh, well, absolutely. Both sides make wild claims about the effectiveness of private gun ownership, and I'm not sure that any of them have been scientifically substantiated. So absolutely it should be studied.
Okay, well, we're going to leave it there. I want to thank our guests, Paul Hurley, formerly with the Visalia Times-Delta, Christine Bedell with the Bakersfield Californian, and Mike Dunbar with the Merced Sun Star and the Modesto Bee. Thanks, all of you, for joining us.
See you next
time. Thank you, Mark.
Great talking to you.
The Matty Report, Valley Views Edition, is a public affairs partnership between KMJ Radio, Cumulus Media, and the nonpartisan Matty Institute, providing the Valley with valuable insight and analysis on politics and important public policy issues. This is KMJ.